Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome.
I think that people are ready to participate in an effort that is, in any effort that is achievable, to make some contribution toward making the planet a cleaner, better, healthier place to live.
That's the job of an activist, to be the raspberry seed under the upper palate. We're supposed to be constructive nuisances. We're supposed to ask hard questions. We're supposed to demand questions, answers to those hard questions. And that's right. That's what this country is all about.
Mark Zuckerman, president of a California company that operates coffee bars. His company is overwhelmed by the response to reusable coffee cups instead of styrofoam. And Trudy Cox, running for Congress in Rhode Island. She's a Republican, an environmental activist, and proud of it, and plans to stay active in Washington. Those stories and our guests this time on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. It's made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Reduce, recycle, reuse. That's the rallying cry of the environmental movement. One California company is taking that motto literally. From Los Angeles, Joy Newell has the story.
Posca is a company that runs coffee bars, places that people stop by between the parking lot and the office to grab morning coffee and maybe a muffin. President Mark Zuckerman says they serve 3 million drinks a year. That's a lot of coffee cups. But before I get on with the story of an overwhelmingly successful coffee cup promotion that Posca came up with, Zuckerman wanted to set the scene for me. And I found it interesting, so you can listen in.
We're a company that on September 17th, 1987, celebrated the bicentennial of the Constitution by having a free Constitution giveaway that we did with the Bicentennial Commission. Everybody was invited, all the public was invited to come have free coffee and to pick up a cup, a pocket edition of the Constitution issued by the Bicentennial Commission for the Constitution. During the Iran-Contra hearings, we rented color TVs and installed them at every coffee bar that we had so that at 6 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in the east, when the Senate committee convened, we had the Oliver North story broadcast on the sidewalks of San Francisco and Los Angeles.
Now, on with the story of what happened at Posca recently. They ordered some thermal cups that customers would take with them and bring back to the coffee bar for refills day after day. The cups were a major success.
They arrived by UPS sometime before noon Monday, and at about 1:30 on Tuesday, they were sold out in every store.
In all 14 stores in San Francisco, Los Angeles,
and Oakland. We have put in the stores as of this morning, today being Wednesday, a reservation form. And we ran out of reservation forms in two of the stores.
What does this tell you?
I think that people are ready to participate in an effort that is, in any effort that is achievable, to make some contribution toward making the planet a cleaner, better, healthier place to live.
Zuckerman's assistant, Pamela, interrupted us for good reason. The head man at Worley, the Pennsylvania company that supplies the cups, was returning Zuckerman's calls. You'll hear just Zuckerman's end of the conversation.
Andy, you're very nice to get back to me twice. Andy, we got a big problem. Yeah, we only had 2,000 units. But let's put it this way. We are taking reservations for the... I'm serious. We printed up a form, please reserve X number of 20-ounce, X number of 12-ounce reusable thermal mugs and hold it for me at the Posca bar. Name, address, phone number. And those things are being filled out as if they were lottery coupons today. This was a very major... element of an environmental program that we commenced yesterday. We're both recycling our polystyrene cups, and we introduced your thermal mug yesterday. You know, we just didn't think it was going to be the smash that it was, and I think that the quality of the cup was what persuaded people, you know, after they saw one in their office and they saw it right out on the counter. I mean, there was no question that this was a product that was worth having and keeping. So, Andy, I want to grab your wrist, pull your arm behind your back. Let's go down to the plant floor and see what we can do on the schedule. Andy, that's not soon enough. I think, that, you know, we were talking about 4 weeks this morning. I mean, I really would like to really lean, beg, what do you need from me that would urge you to see whether we can get that out here faster?
Worley's customers are typically fast food restaurants, donut shops, theme parks, universities, and hospitals. I checked with Worley West Coast salesman Charlie Canaro after my conversation with Zuckerman, and he confirms that many companies are expressing interest in environmentally desirable products. For the Environment Show in Los Angeles, I'm Joy Newell.
Joy Newell reports for the Environment Show from KCRW in Santa Monica. Some very surprising information is also encouraging in the results of a recent one-year study by Public Citizen, a consumer and environmental research and advocacy organization founded in 1971 by Ralph Nader. Nancy Rader is an energy policy analyst with Public Citizen, and she says of her study that the nation is increasing its use of renewable energy sources such as wood, hydropower, geothermal, wind, and even solar energy.
Right now, those sources provide almost 10% of the domestic energy in this country, which is more energy than we derive from nuclear power. In fact, we get 23% more energy from renewables than from nuclear. And I think when we're facing a gamut of energy-related environmental problems like global warming, urban smog, radioactive waste disposal, it's important that we look to renewable energy sources as means to address these problems. And so we wanted to look and see just where the states were in terms of developing their renewable resources, and we found that some are doing far better than others in terms of developing those resources.
Now, as you conducted this study or began to conduct it, did you enter it with some preconceived notions as to what you might find, or were you totally surprised at the figure that you came up with?
Well, I think everybody's familiar with hydropower and the big dams of the Northwest and things like that. But I think people don't realize how much energy this country currently gets from wood and other biomass sources. We found, in fact, that those sources, wood and wood waste, agricultural waste, now provide more energy in this country than hydropower does, or about 5% of the nation's domestic energy. A lot of that is used in the southern, southeastern, northeastern, and northwestern states where they have a lot of forest products industries that utilize their own wood waste for energy. And because those are such large industries and because they supply themselves with their own energy from wood waste, that accounts for a huge amount of energy.
Now, what about conclusions? You come up with 10% in light of depleting natural resources or non-renewable sources, such as oil and natural gas and even coal for the long term. Is it your feeling or opinion or conclusion that 10% ought to be raised?
We found that if all states had done as well as, for example, California, Maine, and Mississippi, this country would now be getting on the order of 23% of its energy from renewables instead of just 10%. So if all states had done that well, you know, I think the potential is obvious when you look at the track record of some states.
Now, sort of the obvious question, I suppose, to follow right on the heels of that is, if those states were doing so well, why were the other states not doing so well? Why are we not pursuing to increase that from 10 up to 23% nationwide?
Well, I think that public policy has a lot to do with it. For example, California made a concerted effort to develop its renewable energy resources in the late 70s and early 80s. That has resulted in that state now getting 18% of its electricity from renewable resources other than hydropower. So biomass, geothermal, solar and wind energy in that state provide 18% of its electricity.
So then it comes down to a a policy, in this case a state policy. Many are observing or wondering about a national energy policy. Do you suppose if we had one that included a real strong emphasis on these other, well, we should say maybe alternative energy sources as opposed to gas, oil, and coal, do you suppose that would be what is needed to raise that?
Well, the federal government really dropped the ball during the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, when the research and development budget for renewable energy was slashed by 90%. The renewable industries survived despite those cuts, largely because of some of the policies at the state level. So I think while we need a recommitment of the federal government, the states also have a very important role to play. The Bush administration is slightly better, has a slightly better attitude towards renewables. It's proposed an increase of 17%, but after 90% cut, 17% doesn't begin to repair the damage. But I think it definitely has to be both the state and the federal governments together to promote renewables.
Yeah. Many are looking for a panacea, in other words, one energy source that will fit the bill and fill the bill for everything we need, whether it be solar or some other maybe as yet undiscovered source. In your estimation, is that a reasonable request or a reasonable dream, or are we going to have to put together a composite of a number of different sources, including hydro, geothermal, solar, and wind, and others?
I think it's definitely going to be a composite of resources. There may be, in the very distant future, breakthroughs in fusion or other technologies that may or may not have environmental hazards of their own, but I think when you realize the contribution that renewables are making today, that is providing us with almost 10% of our energy, you realize that they are the ones with a potential in the near term. So I think that it's both renewable sources and it's also energy efficiency, because we can be using far less energy than we are presently if we just use that energy more efficiently. So I think combine the two, first of all, making the efficiency advances that we can, and then replacing our non-renewable resources with renewable ones, and then also shifting to natural gas as an interim measure in order to reduce carbon dioxide output of the plants, I think is also part of the solution.
Nancy Rader, a policy analyst with Public Citizen. While California, Maine, Georgia, and Washington State lead the way in developing and using renewable energy sources, tipping the scales in the other direction is the state of Texas. The Lone Star State also produces the largest amount of carbon dioxide. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. Congressman Jim Saxon hails from South New Jersey's 13th District, an area around the Delaware River and the Atlantic coast, an area with the largest number of Superfund sites in the nation. Usually, Saxon says, the government, industry, and the private sector go after environmental problems on a case-by-case basis, crisis management. But what we need is something along the lines of the National Institutes of Health, established more than 100 years ago, to provide research and information to the government and to the public. What we need, he says, is the National Institutes of the Environment.
We see the National Institutes for the Environment functioning in much the same way, educating the American public, heightening the desire of the American public in terms of how to more effectively deal as individuals and as a society with environmental issues.
A bill to establish just such an institute is working its way through Congress now, and if approved, would charge the National Academy of Science to conduct a year-long study to see how something like this would work, to see what it should look like, how it should be governed, how it would be funded, and what it would cost. Though many see it as a good idea, the proposal to establish an environmental institute has drawn some fire, Saxon says, citing a critical editorial in the Burlington County Times.
They said that we had suggested that part of the funding for this, for the institutes, should come from private industry, recognizing full well that the federal government doesn't have infinite amounts of money to spend on programs, and recognizing full well that industry has a responsibility and a vital interest, actually, in the environmental issues that we face. We suggested that part of this money could come from industry. A good example of how that could work, is that we recently passed an oil spill bill in the Congress, and we didn't have the money to fund it out of public funds, so we set up a system through which the oil companies and the oil transporters funded that that program, which comes to a total of about $1 billion. So we made the suggestion that perhaps industry could play an important role in funding environmental research, and one of the newspapers took us to task for that and said it was like putting the fox in charge of the hen house.
Saxon adds that the Bush administration, once in direct opposition to this idea, now has withdrawn its clear opposition in favor of a more neutral stance. Apparently, there is some territorial feuding going on here, as the Environmental Protection Agency itself had thought up a similar idea a few years back under Director Lee Thomas. Laurel Bryant, who drafted the bill in Saxon's office, tells the Environment Show that the National Institutes for the Environment likely would be a network of study centers, marine studies being conducted near the ocean, obviously, while, for example, forest management being studied near more wilderness areas. Bryant says these study institutes should be funded at least partially from private sources in order to attract the best of the brightest. Saxon and many of his colleagues in Congress, as they have grappled with issues such as the Clean Air Bill this year, more and more have realized that they lack expertise to make informed decisions, and that we as a nation are not spending enough on research. The Environmental Protection Agency, for example, spends over 90% of its budget and time on regulatory activities, less than 5% for research.
We have a little chart here, which I wish you could see, which shows the small amounts of money that the federal government actually spends on environmental research. The National Science Foundation does some, the Department of Energy does some, the EPA does some, the U.S. Geological Survey does some, NASA does some, but they are all minuscule in terms of the amounts of money that are spent. The National Institutes for Health, for example, spends something in the neighborhood of $9 billion a year on health research. And if you added all of the other federal agencies together that do issue-related environmental studies and research together, you would have far less than half of $1 billion.
Saxon sees the institutes ultimately serving world problems, for certainly issues such as global warming, acid rain, and even the Clean Air Bill have global implications.
So all of those things are national in terms of what we can do maybe in the most direct way to affect national policy, but I believe the rest of the world would look to a National Institutes of the Environment as a guiding light, as perhaps a leader in world ecological matters.
New Jersey Representative Jim Saxon. As to the status of the proposal, well, it's an amendment now attached to the National Academy of Science funding measure, which in turn is part of the legislation elevating the Environmental Protection Agency chief to cabinet level. That bill has already passed in the House of Representatives, marked as Bill H. 3847. And just recently, it was marked up in the Senate Subcommittee on the Environment and Public Works, thanks to the efforts of New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley. Senate action on the Institute proposal is therefore tied to action on the EPA cabinet bill, and the wheels of Congress grind exceeding slow. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. Trudy Cox was a lobster fisherman on Rhode Island's Narragansett Bay when she left her lobster boat to direct Save the Bay, a group working to stop sewage and other toxic waste from polluting those waters. Now she is ready to make yet another move. She is campaigning to represent Rhode Island's 2nd District on Capitol Hill. While many leave public life to enter the private sector, she feels confident enough in herself and frustrated enough by what she sees in Washington to make the move the other way.
It is very, very necessary for this country to have outspoken, strong, well-meaning, and intelligent environmental leaders in the Congress if we are going to tackle the inordinate number of struggles and obstacles that exist out there. And it's important, I think, for people to know that by and large, of the 435 members of the United States House of Representatives, there are maybe two dozen people who really know the subtleties of environmental problem solving. So one of the things that I want to do, and a major reason why I'm running, is because I believe my environmental experience can be a great asset to the Congress, to the country, and I hope back here in New England, where my roots are and where I care a lot about what's happening to our fishing resources, our bays, our rivers, the mountains here, and all the other things.
Unlike many freshman congressmen and women who get to Washington only to confront the realities of political and social life inside Washington's beltway, Cox said she would change neither her style nor her convictions.
I have become very accustomed to being a loner on many of the issues that Trudy Cox stood for. She stood all by herself, and over time I was able to convince others to join with me. So the prospect of coming in as a freshman, as a woman, perhaps as a minority, doesn't deter me at all. It's a situation which I've been confronted with and feel very comfortable with.
Mark Clayton, writing in the Christian Science Monitor of Cox, says she has a, quote, tough-as-nails attitude on the environment. As a young Republican, she is being watched and groomed by the GOP in an effort to strengthen the party and win votes from the Democratic Party, which long has been identified with social and environmental programs, a split that was not helped by the Reagan-Watt years.
One of the key reasons why I'm running as a Republican is based in Rhode Island, and that's because here in our state, it has been the Republican Party that has done a lot of incredibly progressive things for the environment. We were the first state in the country to have a mandatory curbside recycling program, and that was an initiative that came from the Republican minority in our state, and yet became the thing that everybody wanted to do. And right now, Rhode Island's mandatory curbside recycling program is so popular that state officials are asking people to hold back and not be so good because they're doing too well and we can't keep on top of all of these recyclables. Rhode Island was one of has currently got a wonderful land preservation, farmland protection program that 5 years ago was not even in the works, and it was, again, the Republican Party in Rhode Island that made that become a reality. It was the Republican Party in Rhode Island that has done a lot to clean up Narragansett Bay, and there are areas of the bay that are cleaner than ever before. So I come from a state where the Republican Party has done a lot of very progressive thinking on environmental issues, and not just thinking about them, but real action. What I can do in Washington, I hope, is I'm going to take George Bush at his word and hope that if there are enough of us who can call him up and say, Mr. President, you're not going in the right direction, and I have a lot of environmental experience on this. You do need to listen to me. I think I can provide an invaluable step in the right direction, not only for the Republican Party, but for environmental decisions in general, and that's the kind of role I'd like to play.
Cox says her research shows that she is the only active environmentalist in the country now running for office this time, Republican or Democrat.
This is one issue where all the fences have to be knocked down. It is one issue that really can and must unite the world. If you look at the kinds of concerns that we hear from Eastern Europeans, it is one of two things. It's the economy and it's the state of the environment. The air pollution problems that are creating children, are causing children to not breathe so well, rivers that are clogged with sewage, rivers that are clogged with toxic waste. This country, the United States, is going to be looked to over the next 10 years for a lot of advice. And I don't think it's going to matter whether one is a Republican or a Democrat. We're going to have to go into action. And I think as we see the crisis of environmentalism become even more prominent, none of us will really be able to do much posturing. If we really care about the world and if we care about solving the problems of the world, which we don't have a whole lot of time to solve, the fences are going to have to come down.
There are many issues that jostle for top priority, says Cox, not the least of which is our national energy policy, or lack of one.
We have not had any real discussion in the last 10 years about what comes first. Do you put conservation over liquefied natural gas? Do you put LNG over natural gas? Do you put it over coal? What kind of coal do you want to burn? What's the role of nuclear power, if there is a role at all? What about alternative energy sources? Should we bring back some of the late 70s thinking, which provided tax incentives for those people who experimented with solar and wind and other alternative energy fuels. So it's really important that we get back on the track of developing an energy plan.
Cox tells the younger generations that she is not at all willing to hang up her sword of activism. She rather believes that the more aggressively active, the better.
Being an activist is a high and noble profession, and it's a high and noble hobby as well, and that it really is important for kids and adults and everyone to adopt a posture of being the raspberry seed under the upper palate. There's not a day that doesn't go by where I don't say that. That's the job of an activist, to be the raspberry seed under the upper palate. We're supposed to be constructive nuisances. We're supposed to ask hard questions. We're supposed to demand questions, answers to those hard questions. And that's right. That's what this country is all about. So for me, if it's true, and I believe it's true, that this is the decade of the environment and we're entering into the green century, everybody better be very demanding about what they want this world to look like, and also be not just demanding either at the zoning board level or the planning board level or the town council level, but to be demanding on themselves and their families and their schools and their businesses. That if we all, Edmund Burke once said, he who made the greatest mistake was he who did nothing because he could do only a little. And somehow we need to convince young people that doing even a little can make a big difference.
Trudy Cox, a young Republican running for the 2nd Congressional District in Rhode Island for the seat now held by Claudia Schneider, who in turn is running against Senator Claiborne Pell. For the Environment Show, I'm Bruce Robertson. That's our show for this week. Before we go, we'd like to welcome a couple of new stations to the Environment Show. Hello to new friends at KMUN in Astoria, Oregon. Hello also to KBUT in Crested Butte, Colorado. And in Provincetown, Massachusetts, hello to friends listening to The Environment Show on WOMR. And in Hempstead, New York, WRHU. Welcome to The Environment Show. That's The Environment Show. If you'd like to join us or contact us or let us know about something you think we ought to know about, or if you have questions, feel free to drop us a line. We're at The Environment Show, WAMC, 318 Central Avenue in Albany, New York. The zip code is 12206. We hope to hear from you. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.